I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is Seraphim Joe Fortes. Seraphim Fortes was a lifeguard in Vancouver who was a Trinidad native who arrived in Canada in 1885. And over the course of his life, he became a bit of a folk hero in the city, saved dozens of people from drowning in his career. And after he passed, his funeral drew a significant crowd to say goodbye. In fact, one of if not the largest crowd ever for a funeral in the city. And in the just over 100 years since his passing, he's been commemorated with a stamp by Canada Post, and buildings around the city have been named in his honor. And yet, not much has been written about the cultural context in which he lived. Seraphim was an Afro-Latino man living in an environment where racism and colonialism were part of the societal structures and very much influenced his day-to-day life. And that is the lens through which Ruby Smith Diaz examines his life in a new book entitled Searching for Seraphim. In this book, she goes through and tries to look at the rather complicated legacy of this individual who had a strong local following, who's well known within the community, but also we don't have a real in-depth understanding of who he was and how those cultural influences shaped his life. And what's particularly remarkable about this book is that Ruby, as we talk about with her in this episode, isn't a historian by training. She's an artist. And the approach that she brings to this book, it is a biography, but it also has the spirit of an artist in the book as well. So the words really kind of just jump off the page, and it's a very engaging work to look at and study how she goes about putting this together, which is very different from how an academically trained historian might do it. And I think that the differences in how she does this is what makes it so good and what makes it stand out. It really is a wonderful profile of a man and the time in which he lived. So I was very excited to get a chance to talk to Ruby a little earlier. Very much enjoyed the discussion and think you will as well. So without any further ado, here's my chat with Ruby Smith Diaz. All right. And Ruby Smith Diaz joins me now. Ruby, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Very excited to get into the book, talking about Searching for Seraphim. And before we get into some of the content of the book, I'm always curious with authors where they get their ideas and for you, where your initial interest came from and really when you first encountered the story that's behind the book.
Yeah. I was connected to Seraphim's story as part of a Black History Month art challenge that was sparked by Robert Lou Trujillo in 2022, I believe it was. And as part of that challenge, he had invited folks to do some sort of creative depiction of somebody from the archives who was of African descent or who was Black. And when I took a look through the Vancouver archives, it was Seraphim's image that really stuck out to me. And when I discovered that he was an Afro-Latino person, just like I was, that was really the link that I just delved into and became essentially obsessed with for a period of time.
And what about the particular image? I mean, you know, when you're going through images, when you're going through archival materials, when you're looking at things, I mean, sometimes they can all blend together, right? Like you just, when you're looking at volumes of stuff, like what about the particular image really stood out to you?
Yeah, the image that really captivated my imagination was one where he is seen standing in front of a canvas tent. And he is wearing a waistcoat, dress pants, and he is standing very sternly, but also proudly in front of this tent. Behind him, there is a beautiful round wooden table that looks like it's set ready for company to arrive. And you can see the salal and these beautiful cedar trees that completely compose the backdrop for where he is in that moment. And to me, that just captivated my imagination, because I always think about land and I always think about whose land we're on when we're telling story, especially for me as a non-Indigenous person. Those factors for me and those stories for me are critical to understand somebody's place in the world. And especially at this point in time for Seraphim as an Afro-Latino man, being on Squamish territory, unceded Squamish territory.
So the image captures your attention, and then you have to go about trying to figure out who this guy was and write his biography. What was that initial process like, where you have this image, it's captured your attention? What are those first steps for you, right? Like, you know, I think most people listening to this are interested in history, have done history projects, obviously, but a lot of folks in recent years, in sort of like academic history and the work I do, we don't do a lot of biographies anymore, right? That's not something that is as common within the academy as much. So what were those initial first steps for you? And what was that process to try to figure out who this guy was?
Yeah, I mean, first, I actually didn't set out to write a biography. That was not my intention. I did not start this process thinking I'm going to be writing a book about this man. That was absolutely not in my interest. But what happened is that I actually ended up being part of a residency for the Contemporary Art Gallery of Vancouver, which they actually asked for an audio output. And we could have interviewed folks and have that as part of kind of like a podcast format conversation and played with sound in different ways. But for me as a multidisciplinary artist, I actually kind of went about this project in a completely different way, where I was drawn to the land again, first and foremost, and listening to the call of eagles over, you know, the Burrard Inlet, listening to the sound of the water, sitting in the spot where he might have been and looking across the water and understanding the displacement of the Squamish Nation that he most likely witnessed during the time that he was at Eielshan or English Bay. And from there, starting to really do research around what was happening around him at this time, more so than just, okay, this was his man, that he became a lifeguard, he did X, Y, and Z. There's already another biography that's been written about him. And so I didn't want to recreate that. I wanted to understand more about the context. And in learning about the context and doing the deep dives into the newspaper archives primarily, I started finding pieces of things that I'd experienced in my own lifetime, both living in Vancouver, but also being born and raised in Amiskwichi or in Edmonton, and finding so many parallels between our stories. So it was a little bit of, I guess, archival research, also kind of like sound meditation inspiration, and also just, you know, reflecting my own experiences growing up as an Afro-Latina person here in Canada.
And at what point does it then become for you a book project compared to that initial, that audio output? And you as you start to reflect and you make those connections, it's obviously at some point it becomes a book project, but what was the moment for you, or if there was a specific moment that you thought, well, let's build this out to a book length project?
Yeah, so as part of that residency, I ended up writing essentially a long form poem called Soliloquy for Seraphim, which is the last chapter of Searching for Seraphim. And my mentor at the time, Wade Compton, read the piece and looked at me and said, I could have kept reading. I want to read more. Where's more content? Like, this is absolutely captivating. I'm just eating this up. And that for me was the cue to keep writing and see what else I could write about. And at first, I honestly didn't think that I had that much content necessarily to write down. But when I started to really put down the questions around, the very simple things like who did he love? Who were his friends? What were his experiences like as a Black man living at the turn of the century in a very openly white supremacist society? Did he ever encounter like friendships or have friendships with folks from the Squamish Nation? What was the political context growing up at that time? As I started writing about that and investigating about that, I realized I have a lot more here than I initially thought, and a lot more that I also want to learn about. And that's essentially what prompted the idea of a book.
So let's get in a little bit to Seraphim's story himself and who he was, because the book very compellingly talks about sort of his role in the community. And obviously, as you mentioned, the broader context in which he lived. But as a starting point, and this is a bigger question than I think most might initially come across as, but essentially, who was he, and what did he do in the community?
So Seraphim was a Trinidadian born man who looked to the ocean as another possibility for his future, and who found home on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territories, and made daily communion with water. I would describe him as such. And I think that all the other pieces in between are partially circumstance, partially luck, partially coincidence. And I say that because he didn't necessarily set foot on this voyage with the intention of landing in Vancouver specifically, or Granville at the time. He was working essentially as, you know, part of a ship like crew, and doing every little task from cooking to cleaning to you know, manning different stations as needed. He arrives in Vancouver and he's doing everything from being a bootblack to also being a bartender to also, yes, being a lifeguard, but also, you know, cleaning up the beach, being a special constable, being kind of like this person that's also maintaining gender binaries at the beach as well, and things that were kind of expected of him, but not necessarily things that he himself, I am always curious of whether he would have picked those things given the choices that are more available to Black folks in the 21st century. And I still say more available because I don't think that it's always a choice, an open choice for everybody still to this day, but more so that are available than were at the time that he was alive.
And so how much of that context really shaped your understanding of him as the person doing the research and writing about it? Because you're in this time, as you say, maybe more opportunities available and we hope a more progressive, open society. But as you say, racism still exists and there are still structures in place that do prevent full participation in certain aspects of life. So how does your own personal understanding of his context shape how you understand him and how he lived and the roles that he played in his community?
It shapes everything. I mean, I feel that we can't understand him as a human being without understanding everything that he would have had to navigate on a daily basis. And you know, I put myself in his shoes as somebody who lived in Vancouver for close to 15 years, who, you know, is also an Afro-Latina person and who still finds myself in this day and age, you know, hyper aware of simple things like where are my hands whenever I am in a store, because people might think that I'm stealing, or where are my hands whenever I encounter a police officer? Are they going to think that I am reaching for a gun in my pocket when I'm just reaching for a cell phone? In the same ways that he had to also be constantly aware of where are my hands when I'm in the water and I'm teaching people how to swim in a time where Black folks and white folks can't be within the same space, oftentimes, never mind actually be in physical context. And in a time where especially a Black man could not make physical contact with a woman without it being seen as taboo. So there's all these layers that him at the intersection of many identities has to consider to just exist within his role of lifeguard, doing things that for many people were not permitted in society, even if they were white, right? Of just like, if you were a cis man interacting with cis women, there were always eyes on you and there were expectations of cis women as well within that context. I think it's also really important to understand he wasn't just, you know, lifeguarding on a beach that everybody was welcome at. That's really not the context that, you know, is truthful when we describe the kinds of things that he had to overcome to exist in Vancouver. And as simple as when we look at the archival images, even though most of the images are in black and white at that time, and somewhat blurry in terms of skin tone, they all look fairly pale at that time of who was actually at English Beach at Eyalshin. And there are other hints that also lead us to understand that it was likely a segregated place because of the segregation that is still in place in institutions like Crystal Pool up until 1945, where Black people, Indigenous people, South Asian communities, and East Asian communities were not permitted to swim at the same time as white communities. And same thing, for example, when we talk about Brown Skin Beach, just a few hundred meters away across the water, which we know was kind of like the place where non-white communities, or at least a few families, kind of started that tradition of being there and going there. And it sparks the question for me as an Afro-Latina person of, well, why weren't they at English Beach when everybody else seemed to see this place as a popular destination? So there's all this information that really sets the context of he wasn't just a lifeguard having a nice time, but we have to look at what was expected of him, of the barriers that were put in place that he had to overcome, and the things that made his life in many ways most likely, you know, where he would have faced the moments where he feared for his safety, especially when we see things like, for example, rocks being thrown through Black families' windows, as again, even as late as 1950, 1960 in Vancouver for moving to the, quote, wrong neighborhood where Negroes are not welcome or permitted. So I think we need to understand those contexts if we are to truly understand who he was.
And to that same end, as you're going through and doing the research, how much did you find about how community members, a variety, and let's use community pretty broadly, thought of him and how he was perceived by people who were going to the beach?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really mixed. I think what's fascinating to me is that to this day, if you just hop on Facebook and you see any post about Seraphim, it'll still elicit memories of Vancouverites telling stories from their grandparents, from their families of he or she learned to swim with him, and these beautiful memories are conjured when his name is brought up. You know, there's also the fact that he was not paid for being a lifeguard for a long time, and it was actually Vancouver citizens that petitioned for him to be paid, saying, hey, look at how hard he works, look how much time he spends on this beach, look how many lives he's saved, he deserves to be paid. And then at the same time, there are definitely people who don't believe that he should be paid, like city councilors at that time. And there are also lots of kind of newspaper articles that constantly kneecap his capabilities by saying things like, in spite of him being a Black man, or in spite of being a Negro, in spite of being dark skinned, even in his obituaries. But then they go on to say he is still a good man, or he is still, you know, worthy of our care in this city. So it's a constant kind of contradiction with the ways that he is viewed. And I think a lot of the time he is also viewed within the imagination of white citizens in Vancouver or in Granville at the time. And again, with context, we have to understand that in Vancouver at this time, there's only a handful of Black families. And in terms of what is portrayed in the media at this time, it is often connected to the white Southern United States kind of like minstrel fantasy of a Black person being enslaved by a human trafficker, and everything related to plantations, cotton picking, so on, is kind of what becomes the emblem for, or caricature for Black people everywhere. And that kind of, I think, also shapes people's understanding of, you know, who Seraphim was, in the way that in many newspaper articles, he's all of a sudden captured with this kind of Southern United States sounding like accent, when he is never documented to have actually set foot in the Southern United States, never mind spent an extended amount of time there enough to actually have any kind of accent catch on.
Right. And that kind of speaks to the question of how much of his voice is it possible to capture, because you have so much material that it's other people talking about him and perceptions of him, mm-hmm. where his voice could be lost a little bit in how other people perceive him, how he's within these social structures, economic structures that you're talking about. And yet he has agency during his life, right? He's mm-hmm. there, he's acting, he's doing what he does. So for you, like, How do you try to capture and understand his voice when you're inundated and have access to so much material that is secondary and looking in on him as opposed to how he looked out on the world?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I think his actual voice is rare, even though there are hundreds of newspaper articles that have been written about him or something that he does. But his voice is rarely captured. And even when there are excerpts of things that he says that have quotes around him, I myself always question it, because I'm wondering who was interviewing him, what parts were edited out. We're also working at a period of time where people don't actually have audio recorders or anything like that that they can reference back to and say, he said exactly this. We're working with paper and pen and the speed of whatever the reporter is able to capture what he said with. And also probably another added filter of, well, I think he said something like this or to this extent. Yeah. So it is actually really difficult to understand or to know what he truly might have said about himself, unless it was like, you know, a sentence long. Anything beyond that, I really didn't trust in terms of things that he was said to have declared. I do look to, there are a couple articles by Goldvine Howard, who was a close family friend of Seraphim's, also sisters with Barbara Howard, that folks might know, of being the first Black teacher in Vancouver and an international track athlete. But there are a couple articles that are written about him through her eyes, and I found those pieces incredibly informative in terms of, I noticed that there was no Southern accent. And I noticed also the stories that she chose to tell about him also kind of revealed that he was more of a private man that also really relished the time that he had with that family and being away from the white gaze as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier that initially you had this connection to him, and as you learned more and more about him, it sort of strengthened that connection. Throughout the project, how did your connection to Seraphim evolve as you were going through the material? And I'm thinking in particular writing the book, because it's one thing to go through the material in the research phase and collect all this, but when you have to turn all that into a product and something that people are going to read, at least in my experience, I have found that the research is great and I love doing research. You learn all this stuff. It's amazing, but things kind of crystallize when you're writing. And mm-hmm. things come together, not only in putting it together in paper, but in my own mind, when I write something, it really, I have a sense of what I'm going to write, what my perception is. But when I write it, it really becomes crystallized and very clear in my mind. So I'm curious for you, how did that connection evolve as you were going through the writing process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I feel that Seraphim became kind of like an uncle to me in many senses, in terms of just like just a familiarity of what he looked like, reminded me honestly of, like, you know, one of my dad's friends kind of playing domino on a Sunday out back with my dad. And so he kind of felt familiar to me in terms of, like, I could kind of hear maybe the way that he might have spoken with like a patois accent, or I could have like kind of sensed the way that he might have like carried himself just in the ways that I see mirrored culturally. And also, there was definitely a point where I started uncovering things about him and his decisions in his life that I felt sad and disappointed over. Mainly, you know, the points where he abused his power as special constable. And not only does he abuse his power, but he also specifically targets or surveils Asian and Pacific Islander community members that are in and around Ayelshin and beyond those lines that he was supposed to kind of stay within. And it's disappointing to me at that time because I'm reading this material and understanding this greater white supremacist context, which, you know, within the time that he is alive, within a few blocks away from him, has white citizens marching in the streets, smashing storefront windows of people that are of Chinese and Japanese descent, marching with signs that say, you know, stand for a white Canada, running entire, you know, city council platforms on stand for a white Canada. And at the same time, I see him also targeting these same communities. And just feeling that deep disappointment of not understanding, but don't you realize that we're in this together as people who are non-white at the turn of the century, that they just as easily also mean you when they say stand for white Canada and you are not part of a white Canada? And seeing that fracture of disappointment for me was difficult to process because I wanted in a way to kind of preserve this vibrant legacy of him, this kind of scot-free legacy of who he was as a lifeguard. And I realized that if I did that, I would, again, be kind of replicating this kind of cartoon caricature, or as Peter James Hudson refers to, kind of like a mascot caricature that has been created in Vancouver, and not actually humanizing him. And as somebody who, you know, makes mistakes or maybe doesn't consider all of the different viewpoints or other groups of people that our decisions impact.
And I think that's one of the strengths of anyone who's doing biography, or really anyone who's doing history, is to, even when you respect or like a figure who you're writing about or something in the past, is to understand the humanity of it. And by that, I mean that there are people are people and not perfect. Like, no one is infallible. And if you know, they say never meet your heroes, right? Because then you learn that they're real people and aren't perfect. So, you know, it's the same with historical figures, that they're real people and that they have fallibilities and things that we might not like about them. And that's part of studying individuals. So as you're going through and writing the book, I think one thing that people expect in biographies, and by people I mean audiences, is expect kind of a tribute of sorts to a person. So in writing it and drafting the material and recognizing that there are these things that you, as you said, are disappointed in when you study his life, are you conscious of how the audience might perceive those, or how the audience might come to this book, what their expectations are when you're writing writing about those things that you found disappointing in his life?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are important aspects to reveal, because when we reveal these aspects of his life, I think it sparks within us a moment of reflection within ourselves of who are we? What kind of decisions are we making here today? What are the decisions that we might regret? And what are the contexts that we are currently facing in which we hold power that we might be abusing power in, or that we might not be essentially in solidarity with people that are being oppressed by these different power structures that are targeting groups with less power in our society? And I mean, I think with this book, again, I didn't want to write a biography. And even though it has many formats of biography in terms of just like a general life account, I wanted to also understand the land. I wanted to understand Indigenous histories as the foundation of everything that is happening in Vancouver at this time, because we can't forget that the displacement of Indigenous nations, specifically of Squamish Nation, where he was situated, where the place that he called his home, which was kind of like another disappointing factor that he claimed ownership over English Bay Beach when it had already been used and populated for tens of thousands of years. But all of these factors inform the present, right? The fact that, you know, Squamish Nation is now kind of in consultation processes with the city right now in Vancouver because of these things that go back to this displacement that happened at the turn of the century from their own lands. And so I think it forces us to look at these things that, yes, happened 100 years ago, but understand also the context of which we're still seeing them today, we're living through them today, that people are still are feeling the impacts of these decisions, of these displacements. And then I also think, for me, as a writer, I wanted to break away from the biography format because there was more that I wanted to say as an observer and as somebody who also shared Seraphim's cultural identity too, in ways that just, you know, a straight collection of facts did not suffice for me. And so that's where I also wove poetry into this book. And that's where I also called on my own experiences as I was kind of feeling emotionally triggered or activated, I should say, by certain aspects of this story, of things that reminded me of things that I went through that I couldn't help but write about because I just saw them as being parallels just separated by time.
Now, you mentioned how important of a figure he was in the community and how he still elicits response when he's talked about on social media. Has there been any initial reaction to the book from the community and from community members and mm-hmm. or even just in the process of writing the book? What kind of responses did you get from people in the area?
Mm-hmm. The biggest responses that I consistently get is just gratitude. Gratitude for people, especially from like Black communities, African diaspora communities that are saying, thank you. Thank you for actually writing him through our lens and through a more honest lens as well. And there are also many folks that have shared with me just how important his story is to them. Also of folks of like mixed ancestry that sometimes, you know, share my common story too of, you know, not quite being, you know, completely immersed in one community, not being quite immersed in another, kind of being in between two places, but also maybe also more recently arrived to these lands, whether they be a Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territory or in other places in so-called Canada. But understanding these tensions as well of arriving, of having also our cultural stories with us, of understanding also our relationship with displacement and also how sometimes we are part still of active displacement that is still happening to this day. And understanding ourselves too. And this book has, for those individuals, just meant a lot in terms of seeing parts of themselves reflected through Seraphim's story, through mine and beyond.
Now, you've touched on it already a little bit, but if you had to kind of sum up his legacy, the legacy, Seraphim's legacy of his life, how would you sum it up? And how would you kind of say to people who are maybe thinking about coming to the book and aren't maybe quite sure, like why is this an important story for people to engage with now? Again, you've touched on it a little bit, but if you had to give kind of that elevator pitch of sorts to folks to encourage them to check out the book.
Yeah. Searching for Seraphim is a book that explores the complicated legacy of a Trinidadian born man who leaves home at a young age and encounters a changing, newly colonized land overseas. And as he makes his way through these new lands and this new place, he discovers new parts about himself and discovers also what it is like to be a Black man in a mostly white community, and is a witness to the displacement and the systems that affect people of the global majority to this very day and spark us to reflect about our own place in our society in Vancouver today.
Well, it's very well said, and we definitely encourage people to check out the book. So again, it's Searching for Seraphim, The Life and Legacy of Seraphim Joe Fortes, Ruby, if people want to check out the book or keep up with all the stuff you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Instagram. It's Tierra Negra Arts is my Instagram handle. And you can also check out my website, tierranegraarts.ca. And if you want to order the book, you can get it at Arsenal Pulp Press or at your local independent bookstores. It's available also at most libraries. And if it's not there, you can always request it as well.
Yes. And we will link to all that down in the show notes. So again, be sure to check it out. And Ruby, I know you're not a historian, that you're an artist, but if it's okay, we want to sort of include you in our historian community now. You're part of us. You're in now that you've done this book, done the project, because it is very well done as a historical piece. Like, there's obviously, you can tell you're an artist and a talented one when you go through the book. But if it's okay with you, we want you part of the history community as well.
Muchas gracias. Thank you.
So there you have it. My chat with Ruby Smith Diaz, and I thank her for her time. Again, the book is Searching for Seraphim, The Life and Legacy of Seraphim Joe Fortes. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which is from February 5th, 2022, by Ashley Mollier in CBC, entitled Vancouver's First Lifeguard Joe Fortes Died 100 Years Ago. What Can Be Learned from His Legacy? And this article goes through some of what is known about Joe Fortes' life and his legacy in the city of Vancouver, including some of the physical archives that exist for him, from a certificate of appreciation to a portrait of him, and even his porch chair, which are on display or are part of the collection in the museum at the Vancouver Archives. But in the piece, it also notes that Fortes remains a bit of a mystery and is a historical figure that is complex, and there's a lot of depth to his story. And so this is obviously before Ruby wrote her book. And I wanted to include this as the historical headline of the week, because as I was looking at this article from 3 years ago, it reminded me a lot of what she was saying about the complexity and the need for a depth of understanding and studying of his book. And as I was reading this article, I just kept thinking, well, I'm really happy that the book that Ruby wrote, Searching for Seraphim, exists. And for as much as the earlier work about Joe Fortes that are discussed in this article, I have not read them, so I can't comment on them. But just in the way that this article is written, it demonstrates some of the mystery behind his life, some of the need for contextual understanding and analysis. And it does highlight just the value of Ruby's book and how necessary it is and how it beautifully fits in with what already existed. So for as much as I try to not do too much historiography type of stuff, this article, while not a historiography article, really to me demonstrates the value of this contribution that Ruby has written and the value of Searching for Seraphim within the larger body of work and understanding of Joe Fortes's life and legacy. So today's historical headline of the week from the CBC, February 5, 2022, by Ashley Mollier. Vancouver's first lifeguard, Joe Fortes, died 100 years ago. What can be learned from his legacy? And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe. Wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, and all the great written material is available. Took a few weeks off there, but we'll be back for the next 3 weeks at least. I will give you a note if we're going to take another break, but definitely back for the next few weeks with episodes. Already got a couple recorded. Very excited and looking forward to getting them out on the feed. So we will do that next week when we join you again for more What's Old Is News.